Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll continue our look back at the great books that were published in 2025. Welcome back to more of our favorite books from 2025. Whether you liked art or politics or those interesting titles that could only come from New Orleans, there was something perfect for you. Jean Redman continued her series featuring private investigator Mickey Knight with the 12th novel, The Smallest Day. The plot revolves around political violence and hate speech. Now, seriously, I think this may be the best Mickey Knight novel of all of them. And it must have been the toughest to write because it's about such heart of darkness matters as hate crimes and profound grief. Yeah. So put us in the picture of Mickey's latest caseload.
Well, Mickey is, she's a private eye in New Orleans, and I try and keep it, somewhat realistic in what she's doing. And so she gets a call because someone needs a kind of security bodyguard. It's a rabbi from New York who hates New Orleans. Mm-hmm. It's her least favorite place in the world. She was down there for one Mardi Gras and just absolutely hates it. Someone took a shot at her, and killed her wife, probably intending to kill her. So the assumption is that someone may be out to kill her. And so she's taking some time off away from there, hoping that because no one will think she's going to come to New Orleans. And so it was about, okay, so what's happening with this? A lot of the terror is the I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's around the corner. Don't know what's going to happen to me. That they don't know, is it some, just nutcake with a gun who took an opportunistic shot and that's it? Is it somebody part of a group that's kind of organized that's decided, hey, she's a Jewish and she's queer and that's, we get two targets in one fell swoop? Is it someone who could target her? So that's some of the anxiety of it that's going on with this.
Now, you give us such a rich character in Rabbi Sarah Jackson, who's grieving the loss of her wife. And through it all, she keeps bearing witness to her faith.
Well, that was important to me. I mean, I don't consider myself a really religious person.
Yeah.
Obviously churches have often been very unkind and unwelcoming to the LGBTQ people. But it's also, what is faith and how do we deal with it and how do we hold on to it? And how would someone like that use that faith, the way we deal with the world and the centuries of the world that we're in? I've been to several Shabbat services. I was just recently at the Shabbat Pride. And so I know a fair number of Jewish people. Also, I lived in New York City in my youth and I went to college up there. So again, I suddenly was like, instead of the Southern girls, meeting a lot of Jewish people. And so I've always kind of known them. And one of the catalysts for this book is that my wife went to the University of Pittsburgh, and that's where she got her PhD. And one of her mentors there went to the Tree of Life synagogue, and he was a little late, and he was in the parking lot.
Wow.
We hear about all the time the murders and the killings that go on. But this one just felt like, we can't just keep walking by those. And so that was kind of the genesis for what this book has become, the exploration of how do we deal with that constant low level or sometimes very high level of threat in our lives.
Journalists Dalt Wonk and Josephine Sacabo have never failed to find inspiration in New Orleans. They celebrate that in their new book, New Orleans 1970 to 2020, a look back at 50 years in the city, starting with their unusual arrival here. 50 years. Yeah. 50 years.
Yeah.
It's a lot. And you have, without a doubt, the best How I Got to New Orleans story, which you start with. So talk a little bit about that, Dalt.
Well, we were living in France, where we bought a...
Boo-hoo.
Yeah. In the south of France, was called the Languedoc, which is over towards Spain. We bought a house way back when for $1,800.
Wow.
And we didn't have much money at the time, so that left us $1,000 to fix it. And it needed a whole lot of fixing. So we worked and worked and worked, and finally we had a place where we could live without paying rent. And that was fabulous. And I'm a playwright, and Josephine was a great actress, and she did a lot of lead roles for me, in fact. And so we were doing theater in London and living in France in the summers, and I'd write a new play, and then we'd do it in London. And then there was a certain time came where I thought, you know, we really ought to get back to the States, right? Because the thing about being an expatriate, it's wonderful in a lot of ways, but it's unclear what you can do legally, particularly when it comes to earning money. And so Josephine, she was so happy in France, she didn't want to come back. And finally, one day she said, okay, I'll go back if we can go to New Orleans. Now, she had been to New Orleans once as a kid with someone else's driver's license so she could drink. And I had never been to New Orleans. We didn't know anybody in New Orleans. And I said, you go back if we go to New Orleans? Fine, we'll go to New Orleans. Now, as a playwright, that was a little bit odd because it's not known as a theater city like, say, Chicago is, for instance. But it turned out to be just so wonderful. And so we got here and we didn't even unpack because we didn't know if we were staying. And now, over 40 years later, we're adopted natives.
But you came here on a freighter.
Well, yeah.
He came all the way.
I did not like it. Yeah. Josephine jumped ship because she didn't like being the only lady on a ship full of men. And we had a lot of bad weather. And so she got off in Spain and she flew over. It was quite an adventure.
Howard Philip Smith is the author of George Valentine Doreau, a beautiful coffee table book of the artist's work. So how did your story intertwine with George Doreau's? Because this book is such a labor of love. It's lavishly illustrated. It's designed and written with such care. This is the work of years.
Yes. Well, you know, when I lived in New Orleans in the 80s, George Doreau was really respected and revered, and I knew him. You know, I would talk to him at gallery openings, and when I would see him out and about in the French Quarter, I wasn't, a close friend, but definitely, you know, we crossed paths many times when I lived there. You know, I really never thought of doing a book about him. When I was working on the Jack Robinson book, I heard that his archive was at the historic New Orleans collection. So while I was there, I mean, this is almost 10 years ago, I thought I would take a peek. I was very curious. And of course, when I started looking and delving into that archive, I couldn't believe my eyes. I thought, you know, I would pass out from the vapors. So much. Call out the cotillion. So many things I had never seen before. And I thought, this is another facet of his life that we have never seen. So I knew right there was a book. In fact, at that time, I put together in my mind the plates for the book, and that really hasn't changed that much because they were so novel, so new. And then I wanted to build a book around that, and my publisher was very open to that.
So describe some of your discoveries in the archive. I mean, you and I are archive people. There's something about peeking in somebody's papers and pictures that's so much fun. So describe some of your discoveries and some of the things that you wanted to put out there for people to see.
Well, first of all, there were a lot of photographs with the circus
Yes.
My God, this makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's its own universe. You have dwarves and malformed people like the bearded lady or the rubber boy, or it's its own little universe.
Right.
And the images of the circus that he took were so sparkling and interesting. And immediately I made a connection to his photographs from the circus series.
Mm-hmm.
Other things were photographs in color, still lifes and portraits of many people in color, and they were riveting. Also, just portraits of people that I never knew that he photographed, like Quentin Crisp.
Oh, yeah.
And other people that I had, other scenes with people I had never seen before. So there was quite a lot. And as I kept delving into the archive, I discovered more and more things, and I wanted to pull them out and publish them.
Artist Alex Beard gave us a splendid volume for The Birds, an Artist Aviary, and added poetry to the mix.
Birds are a fascinating subject. First of all, they're ubiquitous in our lives,
yes.
Right? You see them everywhere you go. Whether you're in the middle of a crowded city or in the farthest flung desert, you're going to find a bird, and everywhere in between. Then they have such personality.
Mm-hmm.
They have these anthropomorphic qualities where we really see ourselves in them.
Oh, we do.
You know, which is so interesting because there's so many different sides to ourselves. It's one of the reasons that I've always liked working in naturalism as an art form,
uh-huh.
You know, flora and fauna in particular, because it's a means of expressing personality without obviously beating you over the head with it. And then hopefully, birds in particular are conducive to whimsy and movement, color, plumage, their legs and their necks and their beaks and their, you know, their color and the oddities of their variety and the grace of how they fly, etc., makes them a great subject matter as an artist. And in their full panoply, it's not a singular thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so many different kinds of birds, and they behave so differently that it really allows for the artist, and in this case me, to explore lots of different aspects to their birdiness, which then in turn...
their birdiness,
right? Which then in turn is kind of a reflection back on our own personness.
Mm-hmm. And I love that you just admit they're fun. They're fun to draw.
They're fun to draw. That's not to say that I haven't struggled with a few of them trying to get them right, because of course one does. But they have the quality of just sort of emerging on the page without you having to force it.
Mm-hmm.
The less you have to force it, I find, the more successful the artwork tends to be.
And here's Alex Beard's poem, The Dove.
Let us start with what we know, the peaceful dove that's all aglow. He gives us hope to see the light and helps us want to do what's right. For in his skies we look to find a calm serenity of the mind. In great events we mark with love. What do we release? A dove, sign of purity and grace, innocence clear upon its face. And when rage burns to heated bout, an olive branch will snuff it out. For doves exist as metaphor, a hero from a long-told lore. In and through their eyes we see the kind of thing we'd like to be, free to fly and sing and live, at one with what the world can give.
Geographer Richard Campanella traveled all 64 parishes to bring back the latest book. You talk about Alexandria, Brobridge, and Cutoff, for example, and you say that every day people who live there reckon with decisions that were made at the founding of those towns.
Every moment of our spatial lives, that is the movements that you and I made to get to the studio today, can be spatially traceable back to those original sighting stories, even if we don't even know about them anymore.
Yeah.
That blows me away. And it made me realize that all the contingencies, all the things uh-huh. that had to happen, that's where the original idea for this book came from. I had just finished Draining New Orleans, which really gets you into the mud in New Orleans, figuratively
and
literally.
Which was a page-turner.
Well, thank you very much. But it was tough engineering research to do. And it was really, really in the mud. So I wanted to kind of stretch my legs after that and wanted to do something statewide. And I've never really worked statewide before, right, at least not at the book level. And one night in July of 22, you know, you wake up at 3 a.m. and you have this clarity of vision.
Yeah.
You know, of all the geographical inquiries that I do, which is the one question that I truly love, the one that really fascinates me the most? And it was this one. And I coined the term sighting stories. And that is to say, what were the original reasons why this city formed here? Why humans agglomerated in the site? Mm-hmm. And so what I decided 3 a.m. that morning was that instead of my usual approach, which is to delve deeply in geographical questions of New Orleans, let me flip it. Let me focus on one geographical inquiry, that sighting story inquiry, and apply it broadly across hundreds of places. Mm-hmm. And that's the idea for this book.
Award-winning journalist Robert Fiesler followed up his book, Tinderbox, The Upstairs Lounge Fire and the Rise of Gay Liberation, by uncovering another almost lost episode in gay history, An American Scare, Florida's Hidden Cold War on Black and Queer Lives.
She told me, she said, I've got this second set of records and I want to give them to you.
That's such a marvelous, serendipitous.
I don't know what I did in another life to benefit from, basically, this was just the ultimate journalistic and historic breakthrough that I knew was going to be able to facilitate all of the research I wanted to do in this book, where I wanted to make sure that I named the names of the victims, I highlighted what the state of Florida did to them way back when, and I wanted to be able to trace their stories as human beings, not as statistics. And I knew that Bonnie's research, collated with all sorts of other crazy stuff, would enable me to enact like a kind of Alan Turing-like decensorship effort where I was going to be able to crack the code and figure out what the state of Florida did way back when to Black citizens and queer citizens. And in 75% of the cases, I was able to do it.
20 boxes of papers, though.
My husband wanted to murder me. It's a private archive in the back of our house, basically. I'm donating the records, of course, because I can't keep them there and I can't live, but I lived amongst it. And I had to call lawyer friends.
Trumaine Lee, a former Times-Picayune journalist, made his debut with 1,000 Ways to Die in America, The True Cost of Violence on Black Life in America. His own heart attack forced a reckoning with mortality.
Things really shifted pretty dramatically in 2017 when I suffered a heart attack at the age of just 38 years old. Before then, I was writing a book on the true cost of gun violence. And I was using a kind of cynical device, but I was going to look into the true cost in terms of actual dollars as a way to rope in folks who might not care about the young man or woman who was shot and killed in Pick-a-City, USA. I said, let me just look at the actual cost as a way to bring people in. But then when I suffered my heart attack, it forced me to reckon with mortality in a very different kind of way. And my daughter then, who was 6 years old, was asking me about how I almost died and why. And to answer her honestly, I had to get really truthful and vulnerable about what it was that was bearing down on my heart. And that was a career telling stories of Black death, but also a kind of psychic trauma, inherited trauma from my own family history, going back to the Jim Crow South 100 years earlier, and me never fully understanding, unpacking, or processing what it was I was carrying in my heart until it almost broke it. And that changed everything.
Sister Ellen Prejean's Dead Man Walking took on new life in a fresh version as a graphic novel, with a script by Rose Vines and illustrations by award-winning artist Catherine Anyango Grunewald. What do you feel when you see this version of your book through Catherine's eyes?
Very, very exciting, because, you know, there's a saying from Latin America, what the eye doesn't see, the heart can't feel. Mm-hmm. And executions are secret rituals behind prison walls, very few people. So this graphic of Dead Man Walking really makes it come alive. And it's aimed for young readers. We're going to reach out to young people all over this country to get this book in their hands, and the dialogue. that goes with it. Mm-hmm. And I had to trust the artist. I had to trust Rose that she would go to the heart of the book, which she knew so well, and Catherine would be able to illustrate it. 6 years they worked on this. So I'm anxious to hear from mainly from them today about the dynamic of how you take a text from a book and transform it into a graphic story.
Now, Rose, you were the person who brought Catherine into the project, am I right?
That's right.
So talk about what it was about her work that appealed to you.
I knew very little about graphic books when I first started this project. So I went and sat in Barnes & Noble in the graphic section and just looked and looked and looked. And I came across Catherine's amazing version of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. And I was completely wowed. I wasn't sure at that stage if her style was going to be fit what we were going to do. But we talked about it and talked about how young readers, and by young I mean anyone up to about the age of 40, you know, into graphic reading. And the type of stuff is often very, I'm going to use the word phantasmagorical almost.
I love that word.
Yeah. And looking at Catherine's work, we were so amazed by it and so reached out via Twitter.
So, Catherine, when you commit to a project like this, you're not just committing to a moment, you're committing to years of work. So talk a little bit about making that big decision in your artistic life.
Well, if I have to be completely honest, the timeline was a little shorter to begin with.
Aren't they always?
We had promised to deliver by 2021, I think. But things like the pandemic got in the way. And also it was obvious once we started working that there was so much to do in terms of the adaptation, in terms of how I was going to deliver this world to an audience in a different way. And Rose has actually also done a lot of work in bringing in new elements, helping us understand some histories and futures that have happened. So that took time as well. Time has been really strange throughout this process because we've been working on it so long, and at certain points we've been excited because the end is near, and then the end came, and then we were beyond the end when Random House were doing the post-production, and now we're beyond the end of beyond the end.
the beginning.
the beginning of the next phase. Right.
Exactly.
Gordon Nick Mueller, Director Emeritus of the National World War II Museum, compiled the institution's history in preserving the legacy. Now, the secret to your success, as you tell it in this thing, is that you committed all your energies to a common purpose, and you called out, I think, the best in everyone you chose to work with. Mm-hmm. You tried to find the best people. You tried to bring out the best in them. And I think so much of it is due to your inspiration.
Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of startup programs here at the University of New Orleans, but nothing on that scale. So I had learned something about management, leadership, risk taking.
Right.
And I also had experience. Neither Steve nor I knew a damn thing about museums. But we did come to it with a strong intellectual sense of what a museum could be or should be. And it's not that far different from teaching or taking students to Europe for summer schools or transforming people who come to the university to learn. And there was some great teaching here. I wrote something in my preface, just a sentence, and this comes from my own kind of intellectual background. Mm-hmm. History, like art, is concerned with the performance of factual content. The best history museums tell stories visually. In addition to historical records, they rely on art and design to move the audience to the heart of the historical experience, to make it personal, meaningful, and authentic. The National World War II Museum aspires to the highest levels of that performance. Mm-hmm. Now, that comes from a historian. And my own desire to transform lives in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And it's had a profound evolving awareness in my own intellectual journeys from graduate school through the universities. And it came into play as I designed exhibits that would inspire and that would transform people and move people. And so when you remove yourself from the classroom, any vision you're trying to execute, you really have to bring people together around the understanding that experience mm-hmm. has to be meaningful and authentic, and you have to bring all the visuals and all the history and the documents together in a very simple, powerful way to create that experience.
So, another year of good reading comes to a close. We'd like to thank everyone who's made 15 years of The Reading Life possible, especially Tom Loewenberg and Judith Lafitte of Octavia Books, who believed in this project from the beginning. And my special thanks to producer Jenny Lawson, who shaped the program for the first 7 years, and to producer George Engmeyer, who made the last 8 a joy. Get ready for the books coming in 2026. Hope your reading life in the new year is a good one, too. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Tom Andy signs Wait There Till You Hear From Me, Saturday, December 27th at 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Coming up, Kamala Harris's book tour for 107 days brings her to the Sanger Theater January 13th. Tickets available at Eventbrite. And if your New Year's resolution is to jumpstart that writing project, check out NewOrleansWriters.org with course offerings from Allison Alsup, Jessica Guinnesson, T. Clark, C.W. Cannon, and Beth Ann Fennelly.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.